Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 472, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on August 15th of the year 2004. Be aware, before we get into the main body of the subject, that main body of the broadcast, that there's a lot of material up on the web for people to avail themselves of. First of all, sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows are available for download only, also on Real Audio, at a longer URL linked to both the www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. In the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record Program 472 within a week or so of the airing of this broadcast. Be aware that the Spitfire website is equipped not only with Real Audio, but with a search function. The book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Essential for an Understanding of These Broadcasts, is available for download for free on the Spitfire website, and is also a page to click on so that listeners can support the work that I'm doing. Now, as indicated by the title of this program, we're updating a number of different stories and paths of inquiry that we've been looking at over the years. In Side 1, we took a look at AIDS. We began updating the AIDS story. Specifically, we have examined the possibility in the past that AIDS was a deliberately created disease, a genetically engineered viral disease. And what we looked at in Side 1 was the fact that white people, and specifically primarily white people from Northern Europe, carry a gene which makes them immune to infection by HIV. This gene is only present in white people. No other races have it, and it's primarily in white people from Northern Europe. And again, that is more than a little interesting under the circumstances in light of the other very curious aspects of the disease that is AIDS. We'll be updating that in the future. Now, we also began at the end of Side 1 to update the Port Chicago explosion. Long story made short, I've done a number of shows over the years dealing with the Port Chicago explosion. That was the explosion of an ammunition ship on July 17th of 1944. Officially, that was all that was to it. Basically, a World War II ammunition ship blew up, creating the largest peacetime disaster, or the largest disaster in the United States, the largest man-made disaster. Author Peter Vogel has developed a body of information suggesting not only that the Port Chicago explosion was a nuclear explosion, but specifically it appears to have been the detonation, probably deliberate, of the Mark II atomic weapon. That was an early type of atomic weapon that was being researched. We'll talk more about that later. Mark I was the U-235 gun type weapon used at Hiroshima. Mark III was the plutonium device of the type that was used at Nagasaki. The Mark II refers to the weapon that appears to have been used at Port Chicago. We're going to take a look at some new pieces of information in the Port Chicago investigation right now. Now, at the conclusion of Side 1, we took a look at an article from the Salisbury Post. That's from Salisbury, North Carolina, of July 22nd of, July of this year. And that refers to a Mr. Richard Mr. Richard Rendleman, R-E-N-D-L-E-M-A-N. Richard Rendleman was a U.S. Navy officer stationed at Port Chicago, and he witnessed the explosion. In a number of different articles home, the late Richard Rendleman mused about the possibility that the explosion might have been an atomic weapon. As the author of this particular article, Rose Post, notes, the letters sent home by Richard Rendleman don't reveal much about the possibility that it was a nuclear explosion, but are very revealing about the reactions of the personnel that were on site at the time. And in particular, Richard Rendleman accompanied the body of a comrade, an arm of his, who had been killed at the Port Chicago explosion. So, in terms of historical value, the correspondence of Richard Rendleman does not shed much light one way or another on the controversy about whether that was a nuclear explosion, but his correspondence and the article about it is being presented here for historical purposes. Writing of Richard Rendleman's viewing of the explosion, The Hiroshima bomb did eventually go through Port Chicago. People from Los Alamos Labs were on the scene the morning after the explosion. And there were all sorts of other documents that led Vogel to believe it was the first atomic bomb. Quote, a pilot flying overhead at 9,000 feet at the time of the explosion saw chunks of white-hot metal the size of a house flying above his aircraft, unquote. A great deal has been written about the explosion, Rendleman says, because of race. Quote, all the enlisted men who were actually doing the loading of the ships were black. All the officers were white. They supervised it, but didn't do the loading. Quote, the explosion killed 202 African-American enlisted men. That accounted for 15% of all World War II African-American casualties. The black enlisted men were afraid to go back to work, and a number of them were charged with mutiny. Much was written about the mutiny trial and the segregation of blacks and whites, and 50 were found guilty, unquote. As a result, he says, that event had as much to do with President Harry Truman desegregating the military as any other event. In fact, he adds, it probably led to it, unquote. Nobody has ever been able to say what really happened that night. There is speculation, Margaret Stile says, no hardcore proof. Some believe it was actually an experiment with an atom bomb. And so that is the musings of people who have reflected on Richard Rendleman's correspondence home. Still more, skipping down. A July 25, 1944 letter details the explosion from the Bachelor's Officer's headquarters 12 miles away. It was 10:19, Richard Rendleman wrote. Out of the night there came an ear-splitting blast, rocking the building, knocking everyone off their feet. Seconds later, a second blast, even more violent, was heard and felt. Dazed for a few moments, the few officers in the BOQ room ran outside, yelling that something had gone wrong at the depot right across the water on Mare Island. Richard Rendleman's son doesn't see, quote, his writings as adding a great deal of insight into the atomic bomb issue, but just about everything that has been written or produced on television or in the movies has really shed a very negative light on the officers. Quote, and I think his writings shed a more human light on their experience and also provide a great deal of insight into the relationship between the officers and the African-American enlisted men. So he's donated all the letters, photographs, documents, and negatives to the Southern Historical Collection at the UNC Chapel Hill, as well as the Port Chicago Naval Magazine National Memorial. So again, an eyewitness account of Port Chicago from and his correspondence from one of the officers in charge of attempting to address that disaster. And again, as indicated in that particular article presented here for historical value, there is no particular light shed on the issue of an atomic bomb. What we're going to look at next, however, is a piece of research that was conducted by someone who was familiar with Peter Vogel's Port Chicago arguments and was openly skeptical of them. This is someone who did not believe what Peter Vogel had to say about the explosion. However, he then, the author of this article, one Ian Clough, then conducted his own investigation using equipment that not only measured radiation but also was hooked up to computers. And despite his initial very evident and profound skepticism about Peter Vogel's hypothesis, one of the conclusions that Ian Clough came to is that there was an apparent plume-sized area that exhibited much higher than normal radiation levels, and that this corresponded to where the radiation from a nuclear explosion at Port Chicago would have drifted to. And as he points out, this does not prove that Port Chicago was a nuclear explosion, but again, from someone who was openly skeptical, I would say perhaps even contemptuous of Peter Vogel's hypothesis, but someone who was able to maintain an open mind and then tested objectively for the presence of radiation, and has come to the conclusion that Peter Vogel may have been right. Note here that Ian Clough does not say absolutely that Peter Vogel was right, but despite his initial profound skepticism, perhaps even contempt, Ian Clough was forced to reevaluate that contempt after conducting a scientific investigation. This is from a posting on a science internet bulletin board. This will be fully annotated in the description for the Record 472. This is by Ian Clough, last name K-L-U-F-T. It's titled Background Radiation Measurements Near Port Chicago, and this scientific document reads as follows. As of the week this is being written, It's been 60 years since the accident at Port Chicago on July 17, 1944, where a munitions ship exploded. The explosion was so large that some myths and urban legends claim it was a nuclear accident 10 months earlier than the Trinity test. This webpage is about my effort to collect real data on background radiation levels in the area with a mobile Geiger counter data collection system. Then, the point is to see if the urban legends still hold water. Another purpose of this page is to describe how I'm collecting the data so that others can collect mobile data this way. The idea credit goes to Phil Stewart, see below in the data collection equipment and software section. I've augmented the idea by making it work with an off-the-shelf Linux laptop computer instead of custom mini controller hardware. And, like Mr. Stewart did, I provided my own software. Except for collecting additional samples at the same or nearby places, I think I've done most of the research that I can as an amateur. If verified, we'll need to start turning this over to pros in the press to use their Freedom of Information Act expertise and to pressure members of Congress for information. Now, as indicated here, this is coming from someone who is openly skeptical of Peter Vogel's hypothesis. Continuing, historical background. The Port Chicago explosion occurred at 10:19 p.m. on July 17, 1944. It was during World War II while munitions were being loaded on cargo ships bound for the war in the Pacific. The total tonnage of explosives on board the ships amounted to an explosion equivalent to thousands of tons of TNT. Mathematically, it was literally larger than the explosive yield of the earliest atomic bombs that would be used a year later. The effects of the explosion were apparently of interest to the Manhattan Project, and their people arrived within days to study the effects of such a large explosion. The event is better known for the effects on race relations in the U.S. military. Most of the 300-plus people who were killed were black. Other black sailors who refused to return to work immediately loading munitions on ships were charged with mutiny, but then pardoned decades later. The disparity and mistreatment led to reforms. The Port Chicago Mutiny has been a subject of books and documentaries, the Discovery Channel and History Channel, and a TV miniseries, NBC. Then in the next section of this paper is called Urban Legends. Over the years, the accident has spurred a conspiracy theory which has grown into urban legend status, claiming that the explosion was actually a nuclear detonation. Various versions of the urban legend have it as an accident, or even the most ludicrous versions claim it was an intentional test of the first uranium-based atomic bomb, and that it was done to measure the effects on an active port. Some of the story seems to be because not everyone realizes that the explosive yield of a significantly large amount of conventional munitions overlaps with the low end of atomic bombs. Others are suspicious about how quickly staff from the Manhattan Project were on the scene, and that so many reports about the Port Chicago accident later turned up with the Manhattan Project documents that became declassified. Whatever the story, I'm not into conspiracy theories. The leaps of logic, unquote, typically found in them are annoying at best and serious misinformation at worst. Most are written to sound convincing and can take in a large audience. The best-known example in this case is an online book released in 2002, The Last Wave from Port Chicago, by Peter Vogel, as an accumulation of his earlier research. Skipping down. And again, as indicated here, this author was profoundly skeptical, even contemptuous, of Peter Vogel's initial hypothesis. However, he has come to revise that opinion. Skipping down. When the story broke about Vogel's 2002 online book, it reignited the debate as it was covered in articles on sites like Slashdot and SciScoop. As I mentioned in a reply in January of 2003 to the Slashdot article, there seemed to be enough to this that was worth another look, even if just to settle the issue one way or another. Fast forward a year and a half. When I had reason to experiment with an electronic Geiger counter for another project, the idea came up again to check on Port Chicago. The public doesn't have access to the Port Chicago base because it's still in active military use, now known as the Concord Naval Weapons Station. The downwind areas in the Sacramento River Delta, yes, we have an inland delta here, are very rural and have some roads. My thought on this, was that if there's any way to check which could be could make or break the theory, someone had to check the potential downwind areas for any traces of radiation. Without that, it would be pretty much disproven. With that, it wouldn't prove it, but the mystery would have to be allowed to continue. Let's first look at the results of the visits to the area. I'll describe the equipment and software below. And again, in the interest of keeping this comprehensible from a radio standpoint, I'm not going to go into all of the technical data, but in the description to For the Record 472, the site that I'm reading from here will be very rigorously annotated so that listeners can examine the entire argument at length and in detail. Skipping down, on July 15, 2004, Ian Clough engaged in the following expedition. He writes, skipping down, I had lunch at the Sassoon City Marina before starting the measurements for the afternoon. I'm sure everyone in Sassoon City will be happy to know that they have low to average background levels there. If this story should become news, I guess, I need to become careful to mention things like that. So far, all the cities in the area are fine. What he means is they test a low to moderate background radiation levels. Continuing, I went first to Grizzly Island State Wildlife Area, since I knew that that was the next place that needed to be checked if the urban legend was to be thoroughly tested. While at the Grizzly Island Visitor Station, I got a call from Justin that he was coming up to help after all. He had jury duty, but ended up not being selected for the case. I proceeded to do measurements on Grizzly Island while he drove up to meet me at the Sassoon City Marina. It's near the beginning of Grizzly Island Road at Highway 12, so it's a good rendezvous point. Once off the paved road and driving on the levee at Grizzly Island, I was able to turn the screen so that I could glance at the data collection. The highest number I saw here was, in the notation here, 15 microrentgens per hour, which is definitely not normal. The point being that while driving in Grizzly Island in the area where a plume from Port Chicago would expect it to have been leaving residual radiation, he found a much higher radiation level than would be expected from normal data. Beginning again, the highest number I saw here was 15 microrentgens per hour, which is definitely not normal. What I didn't notice until reviewing the data at home was that the highest number at Grizzly Island was actually 17 microrentgens per hour. That's at least a 2-mile stretch along Grizzly Island Road with these abnormally high levels. Though these numbers are not dangerous, I only took them from on the road, which is made from imported materials. Levels could be different off the road, so Grizzly Island could use an inspection by experts. After I was done at Grizzly Island, I returned to Sassoon City to meet Justin. We drove a loop around on the public road surrounding Travis Air Force Base just to check or rule it out as the source, since there had been a Broken Arrow accident at the base in 1950. On August 5th of 1950, a B-29 carrying an atomic bomb without its fissile core installed crashed and caught fire. After 15 minutes, the high explosives on the bomb exploded, killing the firefighters and U.S. Air Force General Robert Travis, for whom the base was named. The fissile core was probably elsewhere on the plane and was destroyed in the explosion. There was a very isolated area of elevated background levels up to 15 microrentgens per hour off the end of the runway, measured from Highway 12. Something tells me that could be explained as where the Broken Arrow accident occurred, but other than that, Travis seems to be ruled out as the source of the radiation on Grizzly Island, the Potrero Hills, and the Montezuma Hills, because there is no evidence of a plane leading there. We also checked Bird's Landing and Mines Landing again to get numbers from the daytime and to cross-check with the July 11th drive. I drew a new chart of the drive. Initially, the colors didn't work well, and that's the hazard when trying to invent a new way to display such data. I found the problem in the color selections, and now the colors portray the data much more intuitively. I also entered the significant numbers manually onto the graph, which was originally the only way to display the data. You can also browse a table of the data points, which are 13 microrentgens per hour and above. download raw data from the July 15th drive, and more details are presented about that. Now, as to Ian Clough's conclusions, and again, let me stress that as indicated in this our article, Ian Clough was openly skeptical, perhaps even contemptuous, of Peter Vogel's contention, and despite that, he investigated it and now at least holds open the possibility that Peter Vogel may have been right. Conclusions. The Grizzly Island data is disturbing. With the new data collected on July 15th, it looks like I've discovered a possible 2-mile-wide radioactive plume which faces Port Chicago. The nuclear accident theory at Port Chicago isn't looking so far-fetched anymore, but it certainly still isn't proven by a long shot either. The 2-mile stretch has large patches of 13 to 17 microrentgens per hour readings. 10 to 12 is about normal background, the highest you'd expect in most cities. That's at sea level. Average background is higher with more elevation. Back on the July 11th drive, one possibility was that the elevated readings could be something natural in the Montezuma Hills, possibly granite rocks, or something else on the ground there. But now we see it's also on the flats and marshes at the shore of the bay, so we can rule out a geological cause linked to the hills. It certainly isn't just in the hills. I saw a comment saying I ruled out geological causes too quickly, unquote. This was just testing whether it was just related to the Montezuma Hills, where elevated levels were first seen. It wasn't limited to that area. But I should point out that other geological causes remain possible, though less likely since it spans different geographic areas. While a granite formation isn't likely at the shore of Suisun Bay, it would take a geological study to rule out any of a zillion other possibilities. I also checked for quake faults as a possible path for radon escape, and the area doesn't correspond with any known faults. We've also ruled out Travis Air Force Base as the cause. There was no plume leading south from the base. There was an isolated area of elevated radiation at the end of the runway, which could be explained by the 1950 Broken Arrow accident. So just like on July 11th, the highest background radiation readings on the July 15th drive were at the point closest to the Port Chicago accident location, now only 5 miles from it. And it's on a direction which would be normally downwind on a clear summer night in this area. I found both sides of the higher background area, and the shape continues to match that of a northeast-bound plume from Port Chicago or shipping on Suisun Bay in front of the case. Skipping down again. If we asked what happened there, the July 15th, 1944 explosion has to be included on the list. I can't ignore the coincidence that the measured elevated radiation is in the place it would have to be if the nuclear accident scenario is true. That doesn't prove it's true, but if confirmed, it would take away an objection many of us had about it, namely, that no one knew of any radiation in the area. If you want to know which way the winds usually blow in that area, look at the map for the runways at Travis Air Force Base. The area that we found elevated background appears to be, to me, like it's parallel to the direction of the prevailing winds direction and lined up with Port Chicago. That was the first thing that startled me when I noticed it. There is enough information that it should be turned over to the media so they can pursue this via the Freedom of Information Act and ask direct questions to members of Congress. It is for these things that the Constitution gives the press the freedom that it does. Also, the Grizzly Island State Wildlife Area needs some review of its usage. It opens to hunting every year, but this data indicates people probably shouldn't eat anything hunted from Grizzly Island itself and shouldn't have been eating such things for decades. So again, from an open skeptic, an open critic of Peter Vogel, now someone who has an open mind and feels that the possibility of a nuclear explosion at Port Chicago should be very carefully reviewed. The possibility that the Mark II could eventually find use from a terrorist is something that it needs to be noted here. Hopefully, the powers that be in this country, meaning our intelligence system and military, are aware of the possibility and can factor the possibility of a Mark II terrorist weapon into their planning to avert nuclear terrorism. This is a posting from a bulletin board, again, about somebody who is knowledgeable in nuclear matters, somebody named Jonas Bean. The full listing for this will be in the description for the website. And Jonas Bean also was very skeptical of Peter Vogel's hypothesis. However, after reading his book, now not available for free but still available on the web, Jonas Bean is not only less skeptical but also feels that, again, review of the Mark II weapon is essential if our intelligence system and military is to adequately defend against the possibility of a Mark II being used for terrorist purposes. Skipping down in this post, for the much longer document available online by researcher Peter Vogel, which covers the entire history of the explosion, the dawn of the nuclear age, the prototype of the alternative technology atomic bomb, which was built at Los Alamos National Laboratories and later shelved after the test, and the correspondence and official reports concerning atomic testing done by Los Alamos ultimately and tragically at Port Chicago called the last wave from Port Chicago. Assuming that it happened about as Vogel has documented, the most alarming thing about this incident to me, aside from the shameless cover-up, is that the Mark II weapon contained only about 5 kilograms of moderately enriched fuel, and it used that fuel inefficiently. But that was enough to cause major damage. There are perhaps 300 university or government research reactors worldwide that contain this much fuel, many with even higher enrichment. Scary thought. The sad news for the future of terrorism on U.S. soil is that even when such a crude bomb is detonated, as inefficient, unquote, and poorly designed as it was, and even if only 1% of the fuel actually fissions, the result can be devastating. A second chorus of sad news derives from the fact that CF and LENR do in fact relate closely to this kind of weapons technology, which was patented, by the way. And it is probably for this precise reason that progress in the CF field has been squashed and officially ignored, because if officials had actually intervened 15 years ago, then that would have been a giveaway as to the real underlying motivation. By the way, CF refers to cold fusion. If you read the whole document, you will probably realize that the key patent now expired, which describes how and why moderately enriched uranium deuteride is able to work at all as a bomb, and most experts will tell you straight-faced that it will not work, was held by no other than who else? MIT. The very folks who doctored their own early results to show that cold fusion was just pathological science. I think that I now understand why they chose the words pathological science. There are two well-documented smoking guns here that defy all attempts at explanation. One, two high-ranking officials from Los Alamos National Laboratory appeared in Port Chicago in 1944, an out-of-the-way backwater port that would have taken days to drive to in a time when there were no commercial flights, the morning after an explosion that occurred after 10 the evening before and had not even made the national newspapers, despite the fact that there was absolutely no apparent reason for the involvement of a secret lab which supposedly had its hands full with unrelated important research. Obviously, they had been there for some time, for some reason. Two, about 500 pages of classified documents are admittedly held in the Los Alamos National Laboratory archives, despite the fact that there was officially no nuclear material at Port Chicago, nor had there ever been, nor was the place remotely related to anything they were doing, except that it was the ideal testing ground for understanding a water-based delivery system of the type that could have been used had the fortunes of war turned against us. So again, this posting from Jonas Bean reflects on the possible significance of the Mark II weapon, namely that it could make the possibility of a nuclear terrorist incident much greater because it would afford the potential terrorists a much greater opportunity to obtain enough material to create such a weapon. And again, this is presented here in the hopes that intelligence and military experts can factor in the Mark II situation in terms of their planning and hopeful interdiction of any scenarios involving nuclear terrorism. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 472, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates, being recorded on August 15th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.